which seemed a boarded-up window. And then language went away, and I prayed in a soft, high-pitched lament any human listener would have termed a whine. We serve a patient God. In the midst of this came the conviction I hadn't prayed for Martin Andreessen, nor thought of him since we set out, nor Jape Walzer, nor Sarah, who were sharing in every way Davy's hazardous morning. I'm afraid I discharged this duty quickly regarding Walzer. Later I would wish I'd spent more on him, particularly. Andreessen, whom I'd despised, now appeared to my mind as he might have to a worried brother. Talk about an unwelcome change. There in the cold, curled against Mr. Ford's sighing horse, I repented of hatred in general, and especially that cultivated against the putrid Fed. A pain started up, as of live coals inside, and like that, I knew where he was, knew with certainty why he hadn't come back out of the blizzard. I began to weep, not only for Andreessen. Weeping seems to accompany repentance most times. No wonder. Could you reach deep in yourself to locate that organ containing delusions about your general size in the world? Could you lay hold of this and dredge it from your chest and look it over in daylight? Well, it's no wonder people would rather not. Tears seem a small enough thing. Thus I cried some, then remembered I still had to pray for Sarah. It's mysterious how comfort arrives, for this too should have been full of torment, given her imminent peril. Yet thinking of her calmed my shaken spirit. I imagined her walking with friends in a sunlit park in a small town, laughing around a supper she had not cooked. I thought of her pleasure in knowing someone like Swede, for whom all the world was an epic poem, delivered from Walzer and his conjugal ambitions. Who knew what goodness lay in store?
"Otter!"
cried Lonnie Ford in an arid voice. I scrambled to him. He was twisting around, mashing down the junipers. When he saw me, he relaxed, panting, and looked away.
"Aunt Otter," he said.
His lips were parted and thick. Between them, his tongue lay dry as a toad.
"Just a second."
I ran back to the horse and returned with the whiskey. He didn't like the taste much, and it probably stung, but it restored his enunciation.
"I'm busted up," he observed.
"Yes, sir."
"Where did they all go?"
"After my brother," I replied. He shut his eyes at this, in resentment or resignation. He shut his mouth, too, and tried breathing through his nose, but it was blocked and made only the merest squeal.
"How long ago?"
"An hour, maybe."
"Give me more of that."
He couldn't use his hands. I had to pour the whiskey in his mouth by capfuls.
"Where's Billy?"
he asked at length. "His horse."
"A little ways, that way. He can't lift up his head, Mr. Ford."
"They didn't shoot him?"
"No, sir."
He lay thinking about this.
"Those buggers."
We sat in silence a long time. Remembering Juval's advice, I asked Mr. Ford if he'd like a story. He'd gone sullen and wouldn't answer. It was hard to blame him. In the end, I retrieved the book from his saddlebag, Old American Houses, and read aloud from a chapter describing the ruinous attempts of modern citizens to update architecture better left intact. In building for themselves, the book said, many a 19th-century workman had indeed built well enough for the ages. It was a pretty good book, I suspect, making the case for honor. But I didn't get to read much, for soon Juval and the rest came trotting back in the blackest of moods. They'd come to the cabin, which lay open and empty, with snow drifted in. They'd found no sign of any person, save Andreessen, whose felt fedora sat in rumpled condition on the cold stove. In silence, Juval presided over the further binding of Lonnie Ford and the construction of a travoy by which he could be carried home. Then we all mounted, Juval last. He shot the horse Billy through the head, and we got away from there. The Red Farm. Dad married Roxanna on a wind-blasted Saturday in March. We were back in roofing, Pastor Reach officiating. I wish I remembered more about it. There was a photographer, a young man with dark wavy hair and enormous energy, setting us here and there, craning through the viewfinder, then popping up to say something amusing. I have one of the photos before me now. Roxana in lace, looking lustrous as a bride ever did. Dad standing calm, his eyes enjoying the commotion. Swede laughing. That photographer was a funny fellow. At Roxana's elbow stands her father, Mr. Cawley, the theater operator. I remember thinking he seemed terribly cautious for someone in such a happy line of work. Perhaps he owned misgivings about his new son-in-law, an unemployed janitor nearly his own age. I'm in the photo also, looking like an old man. Swede, on a recent visit, saw the photo on my desk. "Look at you," she said. "Little Methuselah." Indeed, she'd gotten tall as me. How could I not notice? We came back to roofing at the end of February, the ride into the Badlands with Juval having tipped my lungs into steep descent. I won't describe the buried and airless place I seemed to visit. Truth is, it's mostly gone from memory, and with my blessing. I can tell you the doctor returned, Nichols, listened with alarm, and insisted on hospitalization, never mind the chance of flu. For a few days, perhaps a week, they braced me up with pillows and adrenaline. Then Nichols released me to Dad, saying, "You take this boy home." By now, there was no question of Roxana's not coming. By my release, her animals were at a neighboring ranch. A classified ad was in the nearest weekly, and a sign saying closed stood out by the gas pumps. We left before daylight next morning. I recall she betrayed no sadness in parting from the place. She got in the Plymouth, leaned back over the seat to plump blankets around Sweet and me, then turned and flounced up beside Dad in a most girlish motion. It then occurred to me that this leaving, which to me ached with failure and despair, was for her the commencement of a gallant endeavor. Who isn't scared by as whole a redirection as that on which she now embarked? Adhering to us must have seemed a risk demanding the deepest reserves of joy and strength. Indeed, you'll see shortly how deep hers reached. Glad though I was to have her along, it would be years before my gratitude approached anything like proportion. She settled into the freezing Plymouth, humming a dance tune called Queen Anne's Lace. She opened a thermos of coffee, which steamed in the glow from the dash. She was all but our mother now. I shut my eyes and slept. We came into roofing mid-afternoon as school was letting out. We drove past in silence. Sweet and I knew every one of those kids walking home or bunching up in front yards, knew their conversations without hearing it. We passed a parked bus and knew every kid in the windows, yet I slouched in the car, unwilling to be seen. Swede did the same. They all seemed so little changed. The house was warm and clean, thanks to Dr. and Mrs. Noakes, whom Dad had telephoned long distance the previous day. As it happened, the Noakeses then boarded Roxana for a short time. As I recall, we were home 1 week before the wedding, by which time Mr. Cawley had made the anxious drive east, and Pastor Reach had met Roxana and been assured of Dad's soundness of mind. I'll keep it quick. After the nearly guestless ceremony, Swede and I also put in a few days at the Noakes's. Swede, writing some verse, it embarrassed me to listen to, all about doves in the nest and moonbeams falling on shimmering wheat fields and similar matters, as though something had happened to her mind. The morning of our return, Dad, looking like a man fed on strawberries and cream, asked about my breathing. "It's okay."
"Excellent," he replied. "You're in charge of cleaning up the airstream."
Turned out he'd sold it to Dr. Noakes before we ever left. How else could he have paid 3 months' rent in advance? "All right," I said. "Can Sweet help?"
"Nope, I need her inside." Dad grinned. "Cheer up, Rube. We're moving today."
Abruptly, we crated our possessions into a borrowed trailer and pulled them 7 miles north to a red farm on a hilltop. Unemployed, Dad explained he could no longer afford town rent. The farm had belonged to Pastor Reach's great-aunt Myrtle, who, I remembered, reluctantly gave up her seat at the organ at the age of 102. Not from sickness, She just couldn't hear. In deepest January, she'd given a tea for some neighboring widows, picking them up in her pristine Fairlane and dropping them off again before dark. Back home, she washed the dishes, read the Bible, wrote in firm script 4 thank-you letters and a grocery list, and died in her sleep. An end so satisfying it seems displaced in our age. The farm went to Pastor, who'd offered it to us at preposterous rent, at least until Dad found work. It was a lovely place, the Red Farm, so called because house, barn, roost, and granary had been painted brick red to the furthest reaches of local memory. The farm seemed a place of order and rest, as the homes of great aunts often do. The little house crested a meadowed hill rimmed by maple and oak. The barn was tall, with the plain angled roof of barns built farther east. In fact, the whole structure lists eastward more now than in 1963, but otherwise appears the same. In coming years, the Red Farm would prove every bit the paradise of work and exploration you might expect. But when we moved in, it was a place to rest and to wait. Because we were waiting, all of us, I believe, though my sense of it may have been strongest. The beast in my lungs kept me tied close. I remember Dr. Nichols' inflection when he told Dad to take me home. Also, the look they exchanged. Swede returned alone to school. Days passed during which I didn't leave the window seat overlooking the meadow. The infirm wait always, and know it. We waited foremost for word of Davy. With the disappearance of Mr. Andreessen, the hunt gained untold federal impetus. For months, an irregular stream of investigators came knocking, asking mostly the same questions, and once in a while a new one. Was Davy especially strong in mathematics? Had he frequented movies? Had he acquaintances in South America? From the first, Dad treated these visitors well, answering all their questions transparently, summoning Swede and me on demand and enforcing our honesty. Goodness knows what Swede might have sent those fellows chasing, for behind her eyes twitched every shade of herring. From the first, Roxanna offered them fragrant breads or pastries, and otherwise kept her silence. It is possible to imagine some loving aunt of Butch Cassidy's doing the same. Fresh peach pie can lift a bullying reprobate into apologetic courtesy. I have watched it happen. Andreessen, by the way, stayed missing. What happened to him is no secret, for I revealed my conviction repeatedly. Walzer put him in the vein of burning lignite that ran past the cabin. It used to wake me sweating, the truth of it glowing inside my bones. Yet the investigators who listened to the idea seemed to give it little credit, which frustrated me until I complained about it to Swede.
"There's no proving it," she said shortly. "There's nothing in it for them," she added, disappearing before I could growl further.
Because this, you understand, was something else I was waiting for. Swede's forgiveness. She wasn't nasty, that wasn't it. There were no more recriminations invoking Benedict Arnold or Ramon Murrieta. In fact, I came to miss even those. Instead, it was as though she simply couldn't think of anything to say to me. Plainly, the fact had dawned. As compadres go, I was neither trustworthy nor interesting. Of course I tried to win her back, using all sorts of bait, wondering aloud whether we might get a horse, now that we lived on a farm, or asking about some adventure of Sonny's. To none of it would she rise. I grew to expect the minimal response. Dad and Roxanna noticed, but what could they do? Swede bore no indignation, called no names. She answered questions. She passed the potatoes. One night, in deep contrition, I went to her room and knocked. "Swede," I said when she opened the door, "can't you ever forgive me?"
"Sure," she replied. "Well, I wish you would. You act like I'm some old leper." "All right, you tell me how to act, and I'll act that way."
Can a person be both furious and penitent at once?
Swede, please.
You're forgiven,
she said, but in a voice still miles removed and with eyes still regarding me as an abstract thing. One thing I wasn't waiting for was a miracle. I don't like to admit it. Shouldn't that be the last thing you release? The hope that the Lord God, touched in his heart by your particular impasse among all others, will reach down and do that work none else can accomplish. Straighten the twist, clear the oozing sore, open the lungs. Who knew better than I that such holy stuff occurs? Who had more reason to hope? And yet, regarding my own wasted passages, it seemed a prospect I could no longer admit. The well appeared dry, for one thing. Though begrudging Roxana nothing, neither could I recall a single wonder arriving through Dad's hands since we banged on her door that first Sunday. Blanketed in my window seat, I puzzled it through, concluding that God, feeling overworked on our behalf, had given us Roxana as a parting gift. A wonderful one, you understand. Just what we'd always wanted, but accompanied by the end of the miraculous. Was it unjust? I'd have thought so once, and not long ago, but these activities, whining about what's fair, begging forgiveness, hoping for a miracle, these demand energy, and that was gone from me. Contentment, on the other hand, demands little, and I drew more and more into its circle. It seemed good to sleep. My clothes got slack and hangy. Mornings I watched the deer that came up through the hardwoods to paw the snow by the corn crib. Evenings Dad played the guitar, and the hymns and ballads and antique waltzes that emerged from the instrument seemed all the marvels I required. I got a few visitors. Peter Emerson's folks brought him over one day and sat in the kitchen with Dad and Roxana, while Peter came in with a wrapped box. He told me Superintendent Holgren was mean as ever, though not as scary since his face healed up. Peter's little brother Henry had been sent to Holgren's office for eating boogers during class, a habit beyond his teacher's ability to curtail. Holgren sat Henry on a low chair and told him kids who did this grew into cheats unable to meet the gaze of authority. Some might evade imprisonment, but none achieved meaningful rank. You could see adult booger eaters shuffling through city dumps all over America, salvaging vegetables ignored by vermin. Henry went home weeping to confess his destiny to his brothers, of whom there were three besides Peter, two of them with strong personal resentments against Holgren. This next part is like a favorite song. In mere days, they located the sleepy den of a skunk family near the railroad tracks. A healthy youngster was selected. I love to imagine Josie, the eldest brother, moving through twilit roofing toward the Holgren residence, the burlapped animal yawning in his arms. Released through a basement window, it curled beside the furnace, where it woke in the morning feeling anxious and vengeful. What an awful time for the superintendent to go downstairs after a winter squash. It took the game warden 3 days to coax the skunk into a live trap baited with fish heads. By then, Holgren was living out of a suitcase in Alsop's motel, wearing, according to Peter, the same undies every day for a week. After that, a present was almost beside the point, but I opened it anyway. It was the Spartacus model, the one with the hand. "Look, paints," Peter said. In May, the orchards came with a blueberry pie. Bethany carried it in, the first I'd seen her since we made pancakes together. The memory plainly embarrassed her. She wore a dusk blue dress and rose collar and had ripened to a supremacy that scotched conversation. It wasn't her fault. She asked how Davy was doing and what it was like riding a horse in the Badlands. I gave it an abbreviated try. How often I dreamt of this girl enthralled to my adventures. But I saw that her interest was nominal and engendered by my lousy health. And anyway, my voice had become a spare, unpleasant sound. Not a thing I could do about it, despite all chest beating and operatic gestures. It remained like wind through bones. "Thanks for the pie," I told Bethany, who fled to the kitchen in the company of grown people. Now it may be Swede spied on this most humble talk. Maybe she even had some notion where Bethany had stood inside my untaught thinking. I only know when evening came she slipped under my blanket on the couch, listening to Dad working up some thankful psalm. She sat beside me cross-legged, like a Sioux, and held my hand again, as though we would wait together for whatever was moving toward us through the night. At that moment there was nothing, no valiant history or hopeful future, half worth my sister's pardon. Listening to Dad's guitar, halting yet lovely in the search for phrasing, I thought, fair is whatever God wants to do. On a wide purple evening in June, a 41 Ford drove up to the Red Farm. We were all on the porch, and so share this memory among us. The car was covered with pale dust and jounced slowly into the yard as though cresting surf. It came right to the house and stopped. Then Swede squealed and flew off those steps, for Davy was standing from the Ford, laughing and genuine and abruptly powerful before our eyes, scooping Swede up like some wee twerp. And as we nodded round, he said, "Wait, wait," and the other door opened, and Sarah also stood out, clearly withholding expectation, one hand atop the car as though she might duck back in. How could she foresee the warmth awaiting? How predict the radiant comfort that was Roxanna's gift? What I remember is clutching my brother's side as we walked up the porch, and Swede's feet scissoring in the air, and I remember a strange melodic sound that was Sarah's laugh as she entered the house, and I hoped to hear it more, and did much more, as you will see. Though neither of them said Walzer's name, what had transpired was clear enough to me. The man decided Sarah had been his daughter long enough. I could shut my eyes and see him. He wanted a wife. You think my brother Davy would have let that happen? So they bolted one morning, just 5 days previous, in a car Jape had bought off a farmer in a corner of Wyoming, where they landed after fleeing the Badlands. Having no better opportunity than Jape stretching his legs, they walked calmly to the Ford, scanned the foothills against detection, and motored on out of that frying pan, Davy said, the wicked old maxim evidently not worrying him at the time. I thought, he added, maybe Sarah could stay with you.
Of course, and welcome, said Roxanna. What about you? Are you staying?
Sweet asked Davy. Having weaseled onto his lap, she wasn't about to throw him easy ones. I can't, he replied after a moment. You know that, Sweet. He looked, right then, for the first time in years, his age, which was 17. Back home, he was our leader again, however briefly. He told us how the night he broke jail, he walked to and fro wearing Stube Range's jacket against the freezing rain. How on the edge of town he located a one-ton Chevy with the key in the ignition. How, when he'd climbed in the cab, he glimpsed a police car moving laterally in the rearview mirror, combing a cross street. Shortly, more police and county cars entered the vicinity. Davy crouched low in the truck until what seemed a ripe moment, then bobbed upright and turned the ignition, to find it dead. Swede said,
"Reuben and I would have broke you out if you hadn't beat us to it."
"Thanks, Swede. I knew you would," Davy said cheerfully, putting an end to my sudden dread Swede would bring up our silliness with the DeQuayar's steak knives. With nothing to do but put up Stube's hood and walk, Davy cut across fields, navigating by farmyard lights until a horse nickered to him out of the dark. Nelson Svedvig's mare, you may recall. Encountering barbed wire, he reached into Stube's front pocket and withdrew a candy bar, a salted nut roll. The horse trotted up without suspicion. It led him to a fence gate. For 2 days, Davy and that horse were best friends. There followed on demand more details of this sort, of meanders alone or with troubled companions, meals rendered almost manna-like in hard circumstances. Narrow spots departed in the nick of time. 3 days after leaving August Schultz's, he'd stopped at a bakery and been recognized by its grandmotherly proprietor. She gave him 4 loaves of bread, a bag of currants, and a fruitcake, and admonished him about shopping for groceries in plain daylight. Nights later, in an alley in Mandan, he fed the fruitcake to a choleric hound, then slid through the back window of a grocery store. Walking the dark aisles, he pocketed tins of sardines and deviled ham until every light in the place suddenly snapped on, rendering him briefly sightless, while a door squealed open and slapping footsteps approached. Slapping. That's right, for into view walked a naked fellow, streaming wet, colossal annoyance in his eyes, and a baseball bat in his knotty hands. No doubt the store owner, roused from his tub in the residence upstairs. Straight for Davy he pranced, picking up speed while Davy went leaping away toward the window. Had the man not opted for a late soak, my brother's career might have ended on the spot. But wet feet and wood floors make jeopardous allies, and the storekeeper went down in a sensational and profane tangle as Davy's shoulders were clearing the sill. Yes, he went out head first, thumping onto his chest in the alley. Backing out the Studebaker in the truest spirit of retreat, he saw the storekeeper arrive at the window, upright and purple. The baseball bat came twisting out, snaked over the hood, and laid a long silver crack across the windshield. In all these things, Davy was expansive and good at the telling. Despite the hour, Roxana served juice, brewed coffee. Yet he mostly kept quiet about Walzer and the Badlands cabin, out of consideration, it seemed, for Sarah. She'd lived with the man for years, after all. She owed him little, but not nothing. He did allow they'd had a hard scrape getting out of the place. He and Sarah had scratched a checkerboard on the dirt floor and were out waiting a blizzard when Walzer rode up on Fry. His nostrils were iced, his skin burnt with cold, his eyes prophetic. A vision had come to him out of the snow, a glimpse of horse soldiers. He feared staying put. Following the vein of smoking lignite, he'd arrived at a capacious hole in the native sandstone. He brooked no complaint, but packed the disbelieving horses and drove them toward this haven, at a pace so fast it was nearly a rout. Here they all spent a whole day and more, eating bread from their pockets, sitting until the cold made them stand, blanketed beside the animals. The wind died, the sky cleared. Still, Walzer would not let them return. Once they heard a rifle shot, far off, a barbed sound, a long decay. Dusk of the second day, Walzer sent Davy to scout. The cabin was full of boot marks, the snow around it sacked with hoof tracks and horse manure. Not one of us asked about Andreessen, though he lit on my heart, staying there like a guest on the porch you hope will give up and leave. Sarah was asleep in her straight-backed chair. It was past 11 when Dad went upstairs to see about her room. I tagged along. "It's great, isn't it, Dad?" I asked. The truth is, I could have wept. Such sadness hung about us. I fought it back. My brother was returned. Exultation was called for. Why couldn't we have the fatted calf and tambourines? A little insouciant rejoicing. "Why, of course it is, Rube. Here, grab the corner," he added, spreading a spare blanket on Sarah's bed. It was chilly, that spare room. We'd kept the door closed until now. "He seems real good, don't you think?"
"Yes, he does, yes."
Dad shook up the pillow, leveled the dresser mirror on its pivot, pulled down the window shade. He wound an old clock on the bedside stand, remarking on the hour.
"Do we have to go to bed, Dad? Can't we stay up?"
He held out his arm toward me, and I went to him and put my head against his chest. He felt strong and thin. I could feel his pulse in my ear. He said,
"Well, of course, stay up. Unless Davy wants to sleep, then we'll let him be, right?"
I nodded. It should have been the best of nights. Downstairs, we found the others subdued as well. Roxana sleepwalked Sarah to bed and turned in also. Dad asked Davy would he rest, and Davy replied no. He'd be going shortly. Repairing to the front room, we doused lights and sat in comfort while the moon rode up over the farm. Strangely, we talked little of present quandaries. There was no speculation on Davy's plans. Andreessen hovered, but was not mentioned. Davy said he sure liked Roxana. He was happy for us all. They talked about Sarah, where she'd come from, her fears of this revised future. Then conversation dove and resurfaced in history, picking up happenings from the great long ago like curiosities from a ruin. Therefore, Davy remembered the time in North Dakota when a red fox came fearlessly towards us as we lay in a fence row awaiting geese. It was full daylight, and the fox performed stilted circles as it approached. Its head seemed askew. As Davy recalled, I stood and would have tottered out to meet this dog-like and sorrowful spook, but Dad put me behind his back and shot it. Along these lines, Dad remembered the time he was a boy and a neighboring farmer walked rabid through his yard. This fellow, name of Hensrud, got bit on the ankle by a spring skunk, quit worrying when the wound healed clean, and was taken by fits months later, after harvest. What Dad recalled was Hensrud walking between house and barn, nothing on but a union suit, an early snow curling round him. Poor Hensrud's neck cords stood forth like pump rods. Later that day, gone blind, he stumbled off a bank into the George River to drown. A merciful turn, preventing some unlucky neighbors having to shoot him. "The Lord protects us," Dad said. Davy didn't reply. It was deepest night. I remember his shape in the stuffed chair next to the window. Clean map of chin and cheekbone. Cup of coffee under drifting steam. He was watching the meadow and after some silence rose and stood close to the glass. A herd of deer had come out from a black tangle of trees. They were crossing the meadow. So shapeless at this distance, seeing them was an act of faith. "Well," Davy said. Then Swede, desperate to keep him and honor him, begged that he wait. Off she ran, returning with her tousled binder. With remarkable bravery, she turned on a lamp and read aloud all there was of sundown, beginning to end. Davy was a better listener than me. He loved it all, Sonny's doleful intervals, as well as his triumphs. He wondered over plot, exclaimed at turn of phrase. He was particularly attentive to her treatment of the bandit King Valdez, who he said was exactly right, savage, random, wolf-like, and also probably uncatchable right down through time. Though he amended quickly, if anyone living were up to the job, Sundown was that man. We had him till dawn. By then, Roxana had got up and baked her great-uncle's rolls, which Davy ate with energy to be envied, given no sleep, and finishing up, we cleared our throats and armored our hearts and stepped out into the sunrise. Jape Walzer was sitting beside the granary with a rifle. We didn't see him at first, though he'd not worked hard at concealment. He'd simply picked a spot, in view of the house and shaded from morning sun, and sat still. He'd even entered the barn and retrieved an old straight-back chair to ease the weight. I'm haunted yet by his patience in this business. Davy was standing by the car, fishing for keys, when Dad fell across the hood, his forehead smacking like an echo of the shot. From the porch, I spotted Walzer sighting through smoke. He fired and the Ford's back door windows sprayed across the gravel. As Dad skidded off the hood to flop by the front wheel, Roxana clutched my shoulder and tugged me backward. No one screamed, though the air against my eardrum seemed beaten or flailed. As Roxana got me to the door, I heard Dad murmuring, broke her hold, and flung down off the porch. I suppose Jape led me like a flaring goose. What I recall isn't pain, but a sense of jarring reversal, as of all motion, sound, and light encountering their massive opposites. I felt grass and dirt against my cheek, and sorrow that Dad was shot, and confusion that I couldn't reach him. Here my terrestrial witness fails. I shut my eyes. The old mort settled its grip, and the next country gathered itself under my feet. Be jubilant, my feet. I waded ashore with measureless relief. Stay with me now. The bank was an even slope of waving knee-high grasses, and I came up into them and turned to look back. It was a wide river, mistakable for a lake or even an ocean unless you'd been wading and knew its current. Somehow I'd crossed it, and somehow was unsurprised at having done so. Near the shore, the water appeared gold, as on your favorite river at sunup, but farther out it turned to sky and cobalt, and finally a kind of night in which the opposite shore lay hidden. At that moment I had no notion of identity, nor of burden. I laughed in place of language. The meadow hummed as though thick with the nests of waking creatures, and the grasses were canyon-colored, lifting their heads as I passed. Moving up from the river, the humming began to swell. It was magnetic, a sound uncurling into song, and light, and even a scent, which was like earth, and I must have then entered the region of nests. For up scattered finches, and cheeky longspurs, and every sort of bunting and bobolink and piebald tanager. All these rose with sweet, chaotic calls, whirling and resettling to the grass. More placid, butterflies clung everywhere to stems. Some you would know, the monarchs and tailed lunas, but others of such spread and hue as to have long disappeared from the gardens of the world. The meadow was layered with flight. In fact, it seemed there was nothing that couldn't take wing. Seized with conviction, I spread my arms and ran for it. Nope, no liftoff. But I came close. At times, my feet were only brushing the ground. But I was drawn on, conscious now that something needed doing. I moved ever higher on the land, here entering an orchard of immense and archaic beauty. I say orchard. The trees were dense in one place, scattered in another, as though planted by random throw. But all were heavy-trunked and capaciously limbed. And they were fruit trees, every one of them. Apples, gold-skinned apricots, immaculate pears. The leaves about them were thick and cool and stirred at my approach. Touched with a finger, they imparted a palpable rhythm. It took a long while to traverse the orchard. I began to feel hungry, but didn't pause. Though all this fruit appeared perfectly available, I felt prodded to appear before the master. The place had a master. Realizing this, I knew he was already aware of me. Comforting and fearful knowledge. Still, I wanted to see him. The farther I went, the more I seemed to know or remember about him. The way he planted this orchard, walking over the hills, casting seed from his hand. I kept moving. And for how long? As we measure time, perhaps for weeks, but no sun shines in that sky, so days do not pass. As for the light, it seems a work of the air itself, and of all things illumined by it. Also, as many a prescient hymn suggests, a person doesn't get tired there. I walked faster, pressing ahead as if obeying a beloved command. I weaved amid curly-horn antelope and bison browsing fruit from the lower branches, through an enormous unwary herd of horses pulling up clover and bluegrass. Here in the orchard, I had a glimmer of origin. Adam, I thought. Only the bare word. It suggested nothing. It was but a pair of syllables that seemed to belong to me. They seemed part of what compelled me. And now, far to my right across a valley, I saw a man afoot. His skin was dark, and he wore the buckler and helm of a Spanish knight. And over his shoulder he carried a flag of arcane device. Though battered in appearance, the man moved with spirit. He was like one going to his king, having served to his deepest ability. He was almost running. And now, from beneath the audible, came a low reverberation. It came up through the soles of my feet. I stood still while it hummed upward, bone by bone. There is no adequate simile. The pulse of the country worked through my body until I recognized it as music, as language, and the language ran everywhere inside me, like blood, and for feeling, it was as if through time I had been made of earth or mud or other insensate matter. Like a rhyme learned in antiquity, a verse blazed to mind. Oh, be quick, my soul, to answer him, be jubilant, my feet. And sure enough, my soul leapt dancing inside my chest, and my feet sprang up and sped me forward, and the sense came to me of undergoing creation, as the land and the trees and the beasts of the orchard had done some long time before. and the pulse of the country came around me, as of voices lifted at great distance, and moved through me as I ran until the words came clear, and I sang with them a beautiful and curious chant. And now the orchard ended, and a plain reached far ahead to a range of blanched mountains. A stream coursed through this plain of different personality and purpose than the earlier wide river. A narrow, raucous stream, it flowed upward against the gradient, and mighty fish arched and swam in it, flinging manes of spray. I meant to jump in. Wherever this river went, I wanted to go, and would have done so had not another figure appeared, running beside the water. A man in pants, flapping colorless pants and a shirt, dismal things most strange in this place. He was running upslope by the boisterous stream. Despite the clothes, his face was incandescent, and when he saw me, he wheeled his arms and came on ever faster. Then history entered me, my own and all the rest of it, more than I could hold, history like a heavy rain. So I knew the man coming along was my father, Jeremiah Land, and all that had happened, himself slipping down the hood of the Ford, Roxana's hard grip on my shoulder, the air drumming in my ears like bird wings, came back like a mournful story told from ancient days. He was beside me in moments, stretching out his hands. What cabled strength! I remember wondering what those arms were made for. No mere reward. They had design in them. They had some work to set about. Meantime, Dad was laughing at my arms, which were similarly strong. He sang out, "You're as big as me." How had I not noticed? We were like two friends, and I saw he was proud of me, that he knew me better than he'd ever thought to, and was not dismayed by the knowledge. And even as I wondered at his ageless face, so clear and at home, his eyes owned up to some small regret, for he knew a thing I didn't. "Let's run," he said. It's true, both of us were wild to go on. I tell you, there is no one who compels, as does the master of that country. Although badly as I wanted to see him, Dad must have wanted to more, for he shot ahead like a man who sees all that pleases him most, stacked beside the finish. I could only be awed at his speed, which was no effort for him. Indeed, he held back so that we traveled together, he sometimes reaching for my hand, as he'd done 1,000 times in the past, and the music and living language swept us forth across the plains until the mountains lay ahead, and up we climbed at a run. Is it fair to say that country is more real than ours? That its stone is harder, its water more drenching, that the weather itself is alert and not just background? Can you endure a witness to its tactile presence? We attained a pass where the stream sang louder than ever, for it swelled with depth and energy the farther it rose. Dad reached it first. I saw him mount a shelf of spray-soaked stone and stand waiting for me, backlit, silver-lined, as though the sky had a sun after all, and it was just beyond this mountain. But it wasn't a sun. It was a city. Joining Dad on the rock, I saw it, at a farther distance than any yet conceived. Still, it threw light and warmth our sun could only covet. And unlike the sun, you could look straight into it. In fact, you wished to. You had to. And the longer you looked, the more you saw. "Turrets!" I exclaimed. I couldn't wait to get there, you see. Then Dad pointed to the plains below, at movement I took at first to be rivers, winding, flowing, light coming off them. They came from all directions, streaming toward the city, and dust rose in places along their banks. "They're people," Dad said, and looking again, looking harder, I could see them on the march, pouring forth from vast distances, people like I'd seen everywhere, and others like I'd not seen. Whole tributaries of people with untamed faces you would fear as neighbors, and most were afoot, and a few were horseback, and many bore standards with emblems strange to me. And even these who were wild were singing a hymn that rose up to us on the mountain, and it was as though they marched in preparation for some imminent and joyous and sanctified war. We listened a long time. Dad held my hand, and I felt the music growing in his fingers. "Take care of Swede," he said. From this pass, the stream threw itself over a sheer face, where mist drifted up and was struck gold by the light of the city. "Work for Roxana," Dad told me. Now I saw the stream regrouped below, flowing on through what might have been vineyards, pastures, orchards bigger than that described. It flowed between and alongside the rivers of people. From here, it was no more than a silver wire winding toward the city. Yet I made out the clean glitter of rising fish upon its surface. I thought, "Lord, can't I be among them? Can't I come in, too?" "Tell Davy," Dad said. He sat down on the rock and swung his feet in the stream. It was deep and swift. It would take him in a moment. I seized his arm. "Please," I said. "Soon," he replied, which makes better sense under the rules of that country than ours. "Very soon," he added, clasping my hands. Then, unable to keep from laughing, he pushed off from the rock like a boy going for the first cold swim of spring, and the current got him. The stream was singing aloud, and I heard him singing with it until he dropped away over the edge. The curious music that I hear. The excitement didn't quit while I was away. Jape Walzer fired three more unhurried rounds at the Ford, where Davy was burrowed in the back seat. He also plugged the house a few times. 5 times, according to Swede's obsessive reconstructions. 4 loads blew windows all over the main floor, and a bed upstairs, which pretty well discouraged peeking, and one came straight through the wall into the living room, where it smacked a brass pony given Swede by a former teacher. Amid this ruin, Roxana called the sheriff, Dr. Noakes, and the Lord, doubtless in the opposite order, and shouted at the girls to stay down. Later, she would find Sarah concealed under blankets in a cedar chest, dusted with burst glass. But Swede was busy ripping Dad's closet half to shreds, hunting his shotgun. She found it, but no shells. By then, all was quiet. She joined Roxana, and they opened the front door. The Ford was gone, and Davy with it. Walzer's chair lay tipped in the shade beside the barn. Dad was propped on an elbow on the gravel, bleeding abundantly from a hole in his right side. I was on my face in the lee of the porch. Here's what I've been told of the next few minutes. Roxana attended to Dad, while Swede pushed me over and explored for heartbeats. 9 years old, kneeling in blood and foam, she grabbed my wrist, my neck. She felt the big dripping cave of my chest. I'm sorry still for what this must have cost her. Dad, tired but lucid, told Roxana to quit stanching the hole in his side. When she pressed too hard, he couldn't breathe. "Let it flow," he told her. "Let the blood wash it clean." It put Roxana in an awful bind, for she saw the wound better than he did, its neat bird's-eye entry and gaping egress. She knew he might shortly bleed dry. She has told me how she prayed aloud while wrapping her fist in her dress and jamming it in that wound. She did her best, I know it, for a great long time, Dad coming in and out the while. Then the sound of Swede crying registered on Dad, and she went to him covered in pink froth so that he started up, thinking she was dying. But she told him it was me. I wasn't breathing, or answering, or blinking my eyes. And right about here, Dr. Noakes drove up. I imagine his big car bottoming out in our bumpy yard, a train of blue smoke behind. His best turned out to be no better than Roxana's. Ascertaining that I was gone, for my lung-shot chest no longer bled, no rhythm moved anywhere, and I lay cooling under his hands, Dr. Noakes turned to Dad, who looked him over without evident recognition, and rolled up his eyes. By the time a county car rolled in, and a second behind it, there was, Roxana tells me, an atmosphere of crystalline despair in which the doctor broke and sobbed. Through this scene stepped the sheriff and a speechless deputy, over their heads for certain. Yet before an official word was spoken, the deputy, Gallon Max, yipped, "Look there!" For I had bucked suddenly, as though kicked in the back. "He done it again!" yelped Gallon Max, and then, report Swede, I was seized with coughing, and blood and water spouted from my mouth and nose. Sorry for the detail, but it's quite glorious to me. And Dr. Noakes bolted to my side and set about my recovery in a sort of delirium. It was hardly the first time I'd come awake to someone whacking my back, but it seemed a wholly new experience, and one I'd come a great distance to try.
"I don't know what you were using to breathe," Dr. Noakes told me.
It was some weeks later, and he was beside my bed at the Red Farm.
"Not your lungs," he declared.
At first, I didn't know what he meant. My lungs felt as large and light as a May afternoon. They felt like they had in the next country as I ran up through the orchard, except over there I hadn't given them a thought. Back here, I woke each morning to the shock of perfect breathing. Had I opened my mouth and spoken Portuguese, the surprise couldn't have been more complete. "Look," I told Dr. Noakes, inhaling an unbelievable quantity of air. It went right in.
"Yes, yes, leave some for the rest of us."
For weeks, there wasn't a day Dr. Noakes didn't come by. Though professing worry over the chance of infection or of some undissolved clot cruising my arteries, he came for other reasons also. He came so we could miss Dad together, all of us, and he came because of my lungs, which posed a mystery. One day he said,
"Your father should not have died, Reuben. Did you know that?"
I nodded, but he said,
"Not just because it's terrible to be without him, though God knows."
And here Dr. Noakes seemed to slip somewhere in his mind, then catch himself.
"I mean, injured where he was, I examined him, you know. No organs were damaged. Blood vessels, yes, but he actually shouldn't have died."
And I, conversely, shouldn't have lived. Though I sensed this was the case, it was only years later Dr. Noakes would explain why in detail. His forbearance is to his credit. What 11-year-old should be told that his lungs only recently lay in literal shreds inside his central cavity? Dr. Noakes saw this fact with his two eyes. He felt it with his fingers. Yet mere hours later, it was revealed at the hospital in Montrose that my lungs had not only endured an explosive chest wound, but, in fact, seemed none the worse for wear. In fact, reported a perplexed emergency room physician, it was as though they hadn't been touched. Of course they had been touched. That was the very point. Goodness, I miss Dad. But here, let me finish quickly. Swede, who would know, says drift is the bane of epilogues. You should know that Roxana, married to Jeremiah Land 3 months before he died, became as much our rock as though God himself had placed her beneath our lives. Certainly her sacrifice was no less than Dad's. Who could have poured more courage into us? Who could have given as selflessly as she? For we were a demanding crew. Sarah herself could have emptied the stores of a dozen wise parents. Oh, yes, Sarah stayed with us, though at a distance she'd acquired from living with Walzer. To begin with, it was rare to hear Sarah join more than three sentences, though when she did, Swede pointed out it was clear she would make a fine newspaper editorialist, were she so inclined. For many months, none but Roxana closed the distance, and she, on tiptoe, as for me, I mostly left Sarah alone, admiring her strengths from across the family. A practiced eavesdropper, I'd not have listened to her talks with Roxana for any reward. Though I did overhear a visit or two with love-struck town boys, in which she babbled with forged conviction about classmates, teachers, and popular music. So it's not as if I believed we had an angel on our hands. Swede, whom you know reasonably well by now, quit school in frustration at 17 to write a novel. it didn't publish, much to her later relief, but won her a sort of watchful uncle at a venerable New York publishing house. Now, after four novels, a history of the Dakota Territories, and a collection of poetry, she gets adoring letters from strangers. Her poetry book is flat-out perfect. It all rhymes. One ballad seems inspired by my own somewhat unique future. My favorite lines? Drat, thought dying Lazarus. This part again. Others, yes, involve cowboys. Reviewers could only gape. One wrote that Swede was setting verse back a century and mining ground long ago found barren. He called the book a blazing song of innocence. His was not the only review of its kind, but it was the one that vexed Swede. Against writerly protocol, she returned fire, writing the reviewer a long and personal critique, impugning his education, prose, honor, and masculinity. You poor man, it started, proceeding in such readable fashion the periodical printed it whole, along with the reviewer's aghast rebuttal. There followed three or four additional exchanges, revealing my sister as the better wit. Though flawed, she admitted to me with a rueful spark in the humility department. Incidentally, this public feud impelled Swede's poetry onto several bestseller lists, alien surroundings for rhyming verse. You should know that Jape Walzer proved as uncatchable as Swede's own Valdez. No doubt he went on to mischief elsewhere. Well, the farther elsewhere, the better. Maybe he's dead, prancing across some pockmarked landscape, trying to keep the flames off. Or maybe he's just old and a more sulfurous poison than before. Maybe he's even old and repentant. Anything is possible. I only know he is apart from us, and that, as Mr. Stevenson wrote of Long John, we're pleased to be quit of him. You should know that Andreessen did indeed perish in the Badlands, and that it was Walzer who bludgeoned him and rolled his poor corpse into the lignite to hiss. Having this information from Davy, I could hardly volunteer it officially, but there came a day when a couple in late middle age drove up to the Red Farm. The man came knocking. His wife stayed in the car. He had Andreessen's high forehead, but none of his confidence. We sat on the porch a while. I was 25 then, and far too young to impart the kind of comfort these people sought. The aimlessness and sorrow in their steps would make a terribly long story, but that is another's book to write, another person's witness. Finally, you should know this. One Thanksgiving, we were all of us home, all but Davy. Swede had returned from a writing residency in Wyoming, Sarah from nursing in St. Paul. I was working for a carpenter in roofing, putting up sheetrock and a little proud of my big shoulders. We held hands round the table for a prayer of gratitude. When Roxanna reached Amen, Swede released my left hand, but Sarah held on to my right. Or maybe it was I who didn't let go. And Davy, listen, there's a small town in Canada, a prairie town, a place along the broad North American flyway where in autumn the geese move through by the hundreds of thousands. Since August Schultz died, following Birdie by two hard winters, I've gone north to witness that migration. The glory of a single Canada goose gliding in, trimming its angles this way and that, so close you can feel the pressure of its wing beats. Multiply this by 10 or 20,000 across a morning, and you too might begin creeping into frozen rock piles before dawn. In any case, once I rose in the small hours and walked down from my rented bed to a pine bench cafe, which in season is full of hunters sociably forking down eggs by 5 in the morning. Outside, leaves beat past in a wet wind. What I wanted was pancakes and sausage, so I ordered and took a clean cup and helped myself to coffee. Davy came in the door before my short stack arrived. He wore a down jacket and new lace-up boots, at last some decent gloves. He sat down. You hunting alone, Rube? It's not the easiest way to keep up with your brother. Some years he coasts into that town in my shadow. He's the next man in the cafe, the voice behind me at the gas station. Some years he doesn't show at all. Exile has its hollow hours. Some years I've noticed odd tilts in his speech. No doubt he has lived among accents, I hope in pleasant places, but he tells me painfully little. He asks and asks. So I give him the news. He reads all of Swede's work. He sends regards and comments. It drives her wild that he never appears in the midst of what she's doing, but she knows he's crazy about her. Twice Swede has accompanied me, hoping to see him, neither time with success. Possibly he dreads what she might ask of him. "You got awfully big," he told me that first morning in the cafe. So I told him what happened, about my foray into the next country and Dad catching up with me there. Belief is a hard thing to gauge where Davy is concerned. "And he sent you back?" I told him Dad didn't exactly send me, but that I could go no farther, that it seemed a transaction had taken place on my behalf.
"Breathe," Davy said. "Let's see you breathe."
Well, that was the easy part. Harder was describing that land itself, its upward-running river, its people on the move and ground astir with song. For just as that music stays outside the pattern I would give it, so does my telling fall pitifully short of what the place is. What mortal creations are language and memory? And so I sound like a man making the most marginal sense, as if I was describing one of those dreams that seemed so genuine at the time. "Don't you ever doubt it?" Davy asked. And in fact I have, and perhaps will again. But here is what happens. I look out the window at the red farm, for here we live, Sarah and I, in a new house across the meadow, a house built by capable arms and open lungs and joyous sweat. Maybe I see our daughter, home from school, picking plums or apples for Roxana. Maybe one of our sons, reading on the grass or painting an upended canoe. Or maybe Sarah comes into the room. My darling Sarah, with Mr. Cassidy's beloved rolls on a steaming plate. Then I breathe deeply, and certainty enters into me like light, like a piece of science, and curious music seems to hum inside my fingers. Is there a single person on whom I can press belief? No, sir. All I can do is say, here's how it went. Here's what I saw. I've been there and am going back. Make of it what you will.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.